that of vice. The Excelsior El Dorado of a sexish, bottom-wagging, most arch-old Nick sunk in a costly and succulent rut. And that is what Berlin wanted. If by Berlin is meant that gilt-edged, lime-lit fraction that enjoys Berlin im Licht. This is the name of the chapter, section, Berlin im Light. I don't know, maybe that means Berlin lit up, or Berlin at night or something. He says, Paris has nothing to show at all like Berlin Westens. New York under Prohibition is a poor place in comparison. So he's saying that the sort of like the wealth of the 20s, the boom, crystallized in this part of Berlin. It was a 24/7 party. So I'm going to read one part again. No city has anything on it as regards the stark suggestions of being the Hauptstadt of vice, the Excelsior El Dorado of a sexist, bottom-wagging, most arch-old Nick sunk in a costly and succulent rut. And that is what Berlin wanted. If by Berlin is meant that gilt-edged, lime-lit fraction that enjoys Berlin im Licht. Paris has nothing to show. New York under Prohibition is a poor place in comparison. Only drinking, let's see, only drinking wood alcohol and bad Chianti in luxurious cellars and gilded slums, New York lacks as a public place. The licorice amenities of a fallen world, fallen in quotes, best symbolized perhaps by such resorts as El Dorado, the El Dorado of the Mosestrasse. There are two, so there's two places. So he's saying it's nothing, New York under Prohibition, only drinking. So Berlin has these wood alcohol and the slummish scenes where New York doesn't. Only drinking lax. Yeah. In harmony with all this, gang violence in Berlin abounds. The arms who halter or ponce flattens and flourishes. Berlin can show what is probably the most oddly unlovely gunmen of the earth. The Berlin correspondent of the Daily Express remarked the other day, December 15, 1930, in the course of a description of a night battle between armed police and 300 gunmen that, quote, Berlin is now assuming the character of a European Chicago, unquote. That this assimilation of Berlin to Chicago is not confined to foreign observers may be seen from the following account from Der Angriff to a German paper, January 15, 1931, except that here it is claimed that the state of affairs in Chicago is already surpassed. So that Berlin's outdone Chicago in violence and gang warfare. And it has a long quote in German. I don't know what that's saying. Then Wyndham Lewis says, yes, Berlin is quite Chicagoan in the matter of the Untermensch, but it is something more, far more, as indeed is indicated in the above account, the German account, which we didn't translate. It is in contrast to the American city, New York, also, and Pardesis Le Marche, at least Borgian in its political temper. So he's pointing out that's the Borgias, the evil Italian guys at the time of the Renaissance. So he's saying there's some bad stuff going on in this city. No week passes without murderous affrays between the people I'm writing about here and the Marxist murder gangs and armed bravos of other extreme left-wing political sects. So he's talking about these political gangs shooting it out. Now remember, the crash has happened. New York has crashed in 1929. It's getting tense by 1930 and 31 economically. I mean, most people say that's when the Depression hits, in 1931. Takes a couple of years for it to trickle down from Wall Street. So, yeah, it's just a little bit more. Disorder is rampant and is checked with firearms and gummikopums in the streets, and left at that, not suppressed by iron decrees of the supreme authority, as one would expect. So he's saying all this disorder goes on and nobody cleans it up or covers it up. Disorder is rampant and is checked with firearms and gummikopums in the streets, and left at that, not suppressed by iron decrees of the supreme authority, as one would expect. The reason for this is not the impotence of the Prussian administration. Remember how Ions told us about the secret power of Prussia in the British royalty? The reason for this is not the impotence of the Prussian administration. It is difficult to see what it is, in fact, if it is not the result of a settled policy, or at all events, of a temper that grudges police defense on behalf of noxious organizations. What's he saying there? It could be our suits the book. Sounds like the average political or observer thinks this is the best way to have it settled. So it's not the impotence of the Prussian administration. They actually want it to happen. It is difficult to see what it is, in fact, if it is not the result of a settled policy, or at all events of a temper that grudges police defense on behalf of noxious organizations. Street violence, it could be argued, suits the book of the Republican caucus. So at least it would seem the political opponents of the present Republican regime, the most powerful of which are the Nazis or National Socialists, can only be held in check by constant police violence. The communist needs that too, but the communist helps the police to beat and shoot the Nazis. So, except that the Nazi, violence all around, but he has in brackets. So, except that the Nazis disarmed on all occasions and imprisoned for long terms, besides that, if he is caught in possession of a penknife or pea shooter, wait, let me read that. So, except that the Nazi, he's unfairly arrested, is disarmed on all occasions and imprisoned for long terms if he's caught in possession of a penknife or a pea shooter. So violence all around, when it is not Nazi, is not too absolutely discouraged. At least so much may, I think, be asserted by the Republican government of the Reich. Patrol wagons packed with armed police hurry from spot to spot, from dusk to daybreak, bludgeoning, shooting, and arresting. So basically got a civil war happening already. Armed bands of one sort and another are usually on the move as well, and more or less seriously clashing. A guy named Boileau, describing Paris in the days of the King's Son, that would be the Sun King, Louis XIV, that would be 200 years before, I guess, wrote as follows. And the bourgeois citizen of Berlin, perhaps less wittily exaggerating, could write much the same today of his city. Fortunately, it's all in French, so we don't know what Bellew wrote, but I guess Paris had these issues back then. Then Lewis goes into the Horace Wessel song. I keep saying LaRouche because LaRouche has written a lot of stuff on Germany and is an expert on Germany, has lived there for many years. So the Horace Wessel song, with which all National Socialist meetings terminate, bears witness to these conditions. For it is the song written by a young Nazi storm leader who was shot in his lodgings by a communist gunman who went there with his band at the request of Wessel's landlady, who desired to be rid of her fascist lodger, whose politics displeased her. So it's a song written by a young Nazi who was shot by a communist who went there because the owner, the landlady, did not like the Nazis. So it sounds like the Nazis are very unpopular. But literally thousands of National Socialists have been killed and wounded in affrays during the last 12 months in all parts of Germany. Their Sturmbegleiter are forever coming up against a roll commando of the Reichsbanner or falling into a Marxist ambush of the Red Front fighters. And the Nazis have paid this back in kind. Marxists and Reichsbannleute have fallen beneath their daggers and bullets, for sometimes they have been driven to arm. It means the Nazis have been driven to arm. They paid this back and have fallen beneath their daggers. Oh, I guess it's a shame that the Nazis had daggers and bullets and killed the Marxists. So Berlin is Chicago, says Lewis. Only more so, if anything, but minus bootleg. And with that great difference, that politics account for much of the street violence. The Marxist gangs take their orders from Moscow instead of from Al Capone, the mafia leader in Chicago. Europe is, after all, no bigger than the States, than the United States. There is a great deal of coming and going between these capitals, between, you know, Moscow and Berlin. Hitler's racket is a rival racket, but it is opposite brands of revolution that these guys and mugs traffic in. And as far as the National Socialists are concerned, the pockets of the participants are not lined by any means, or their nests feathered as a consequence of their dangerous tasks. And as far as the National Socialists are concerned, the pockets of the participants are not lined by any means, or their nests feathered as a consequence of their dangerous tasks. I guess it means that they're not stealing stuff. It is a very disinterested activity. That means a very detached activity. Also, whereas the communist is invariably armed, the Nazi has only his fists or sticks to defend himself with, owing to the discrimination of the Republican police authorities. From the start, the Nazis have been incessantly denounced, harassed, and disarmed. The Nazi organization further lives under the perpetual threat of a Wehrbund of suppression throughout Germany. In consequence, the Nazi leaders recently have been compelled to issue orders to the effect that any National Socialist discovered in possession of firearms will be expelled from the party. So they have to be keep a clean nose more than anybody in any of the other gangs. So today, most of the killing and wounding is done by the other side. Yet in spite of the strict orders to the contrary, it does sometimes happen that Nazis arm themselves, as I have said, in response to extreme provocation and in face of the certainty of death if they are not in a position to defend themselves. In a small mining town where they may be comparatively weak in numbers, for instance, okay, so he's saying they have to defend themselves. For example, in a small mining town where they may be comparatively weak in numbers, for instance, or at moments of intensified communist activity. Thus, the brother of Dr. Goebbels, the Berlin leader, is at present in jail with another man for killing a communist in the course of a clash in a small Rhine town. Goebbels' mother has now been compelled to move to another state because of the repeated threat to her life from local communists. And there's no part of Germany from which news does not come daily of street battles. So it is a civil war, this is the last sentence. So it is a civil war of sorts that is in progress from the Alps to the North Sea.
All participants are now unmuted.
Oh, that's all I'll read today. So what do you think of that? Do they have civil war going on here? I mean, not here in Hawaii, but... I guess that's secret. That's the mafia gangs, you know, after World War II. You had the mafia gangs, but, I mean, they're just utter chaos. Maybe the conditions are pretty poor there in Berlin, right? Maybe it's already pretty, a lot of starving and stuff, so the people are desperate.
Yeah, it looked, sound that way. I mean, it was, blew me away about the comparison of, Berlin being the European Chicago.
You never heard of that before, eh? Like,
no.
You don't in the footage, see, this is the detail of a book or like a newspaper article. The footage you have is the Nazis storming around. The Nazis are the guys who are beating everybody up, you know? Either Lewis is lying or deluded or right, that the Nazis are the weak minority, you know, and they... they're on the defensive all the time. The communists, they've got Moscow helping them. Now, you know, you can go into the Alex Jones world or conspiracy sites, and they will be saying that the Rockefellers or the Rothschilds or some bankers were funding the Nazis. George Bush's family was funding the Nazis. But I don't know when that is. You know, is that 1934, 35, not in 1930? So, if people were very politicized in the 30s, that would be the effect of the radio world, the radio paranoia. So if you had any leaning toward, the left, you wouldn't like Lewis, writing this way as if, the Nazis were being bullied. You know, this first chapter would set people off, especially, you know, because, you know, these thugs that are upstart thugs. But, yeah, you do not have those pictures of Berlin with gangs shooting themselves. It's just, you know, the Nazis marching around Berlin scaring people, right? That's the footage you get.
Yes.
Now, So that's a new thing for you, that there's this civil war going on.
Yes, totally new.
Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, so... Go ahead.
I also found it interesting his reference to the... did he give a description of the public address system and the lights of the electrical drum fire? Was that the context?
You heard that phrase?
Yes.
Electrical, no. He talks about electricity, in fashionable electricity. I don't know where the drum fire, but if you heard it, yeah. But he's going to have to go into a little more detail for me to be impressed. You know, but he is beginning by saying, you know, this place, this key Broadway place is just lit up. Where there's quite, you know, from a moral point of view of Christian morality, quite corrupt, you know, one big party scene going on with these gangs. It's like McLuhan used to say when he talked about the embedding of death or sex imagery in the ads that his colleague Wilson Brian Key, I think his name was Mr. Key. He writes that when you get a lot of sex happening, you're going to have a lot of violence. They go hand in hand. So you've got these gang wars as well as a lot of whatever you call it, pornography, promiscuity, irresponsible, don't let your kids know about it kind of stuff going on. So they go together, the sex and the violence.
Hmm.
You ever heard much about that? That the more sex that's happening, the more violent is the climate?
No, I remember hearing you speak of that before when I first started listening, but never as far as outside of this environment. No, I've never heard that before.
Yeah. McLuhan used to point that out. So McLuhan said, they got this sexual imagery embedded into the ads, but they have to have the concomitant violent images, so the deaths and skulls and that embedded in the ads. They go together.
Hmm.
It says, just the first sentence of the next section, Berlin, it's Western Babylon. Western Babylon is, as everybody knows, the courtier general, the general quarters of dogmatic perversity, the pervert's paradise, the mecca of both lesb and soul. So it's lesbian and sodomy. So that's a little trailer for next week, a little hint of what's coming. So old Lewis, he has to go where the action is, you know, he wants to see what's going on. As an artist, he has to be looking at the present.
It sounded like he was already in a war zone.
Yeah, that's right. There was a war happening there, civil war. But so far, he is looking. Look, he's putting. How could he? Is he? He's a Nazi. Well, he's describing these guys as thugs. You know, he's not impressed with them. He's not. He's not supporting them. He's describing them as creeps and thugs. The whole gang of them, all parties. Right? He's saying, hey, these guys are real dangerous. So there's nothing to put Lewis down for yet, right?
No. Also got a backfill from yours and Ion's about the Prussia. There
yes.
was a Prussian reference in there as well.
Yeah, the Prussian That's... Republic or something. And, you know, the Prussian gang and Bismarck have diminished on the surface by the 30s. And they were big in the 80 years, 50 years before. Now, they got a picture here in this third section. A prominent figure in the Berlin underworld. Holy shit, man. Is this guy one ugly dude? He's like a bull. He's got a huge head. And he's looking down. He's mean. But back then, you had to be tough, man, when you were in the underworld. You're up against everybody else who's tough, right?
Yeah, so, you know what's funny, Bob, is that was your description when you were talking about this book at Bobfest about how ugly the guy was. I remember that. Just what you said about
that's
Bobfest.
Right. Yeah, that guy's pitcher, man, between 24 and 25 is a me, that guy. I mean, he's just frowning and growling in his face is natural. You know, I don't think the guy ever had a pleasant ripple on his face, according to this picture. But, you know, these aren't granola eaters. These aren't vegetarians. These are hardware guys who put up a 300 years of visual space and kinetic machinery. They don't have any electric tactility smoothing them out like most of the guys who call in here, the Uris, the Derricks, these lily-livered, like, guys who never worked never even saw a job, let alone do one.
Wasn't that one of the descriptions? It said that the only thing that they had, the Nazis had, or those, his description was that they had only their fists and clubs or something. It was some reference.
Yeah, they didn't have much. And occasionally they had got a knife.
Yeah.
They weren't being supported, whereas the communists and the right wings were. The Nazis are just, they're like punks. They're like the Beatles. You know, they're a new media phenomenon. They're a new aberration. They're actually not your normal literate politico, you know. They are a mood, a mob, a flash mob running around claiming it's political. You know, and
yeah.
they get beat up by the establishment thugs, the establishment underworld, the respectable underworld, has the advantage to beat these guys up. Yeah, maybe we should unmute, what's her name? Sarah. This is like the squatters up in Dayton, Ohio, 10 years, 15 years ago that she hung out with. The guy's constantly getting beat up by whoever. The church sub genius probably came in and beat you up, right? Didn't you say that about Stang? Didn't he try to beat you up once? So, so there it is, the opening wisdom. What was that? You're not muted, Sarah. Anyways, that's the opening perspective of. He's a pretty good writer, right?
Yes.
Hope my reading is. Does it justice. Okay, so what we got to do now, we got to take a break, rest my vocal cords before we go into the second part of the course, where we jump up to the later. So I'm reading something before World War II, and then we're going to jump to something after World War II. So what do we do to entertain ourselves here? Well, Bert, why don't you bring up some issues that have intrigued you this week? You talk a bit.
Okay. I just finished Don Thiel's Joyce Light and the Road to the Digital Culture.
Yeah.
And I found some interesting references in the last part of the chapter.
About the middle of the book or the first third? Where is this chapter in the book?
It's going into the last third.
Like, oh, okay, so you've done over half.
Yes. And it's, it goes back, I think it was last week or the week before I was talking about chiasmos. And what this part of the chapter is going into is describing, like, the difference between Pope's Dunkyad's reference to chaos and Joyce's, the Finnegan's Wake reference to chaos.
And what was the first one? You said Don Quixote?
No, Pope's Dunciad.
The Dunciad. The Dunciad.
Dunciad, yes.
Yeah.
And how he's saying that Pope's Dunciad foresees a world confronted by the Newtonian and Cartesian worldview, a world where literacy assumes a monarchical primacy as descending into chaos, night, and darkness. Joyce's Wake. Primacy is descent. Oh, I'm rereading. I'm sorry. Joyce's Wake, coming forth by day, foresees a Cartesian realization that as chaos comes to be realized as a chiasmos, the night becomes a daylight dilate moving towards awakening into the day. For one of Joyce's favorite phrases is wait till Finnegan's wakes.
Mm. Now that's an important idea that Pope, Alexander Pope in the 1740s did a media ecology, their times version, attack on the commercialization of the printing press. And people, the citizens just lost in reading stupid books and crappy literature. And so he saw that the sensibility was going into a dark age, a night. And here's the famous last line, the chaos of the night. So he's seeing the disservice of literacy that people weren't really writing about. They thought it was a wonderful new era. Now, then Joyce comes in, you know, 200 years later and says, well, yes, we ended up in a dark, literate, dark age. Not that Joyce was against books, but there was the terrible 19th century. As you hear, who was it, McLuhan I was playing? What did I? Oh, no, it's just an old recording way back I played in August. But if you went back to the August 30 show, McLuhan's talking about how violent the 19th century was. So Joyce is seeing us coming out of this new world. There's something different happening with the electric world that's going to move us away from the night that we've been in since Alexander Pope's era, move into a new light, a new dawn, a new era with the electric media. That'd be the hopeful version of it. So that's what that means, is that Finney's Wake is the end of a 200-year history of social criticism by poets and essayists and philosophers. And Joyce is seeing something new afoot. But it includes the chaosmos. Can you handle the chaosmos, the non-visual, post-visual, invisible dynamics of the senses?
Yes. And it makes me think of what you're doing with Payday. That it's an active, ongoing engagement with Ion, or and with you, that to use the wordplay to discuss so many or any subject that someone brings up outlines it in this forum. Just to, for example, like Yuri came on and listened and played with the words, but it gives him something that when he you know, hangs up the phone this week may have an effect on him in some way because of this new environment that you're introducing.
Right. Yeah, we are announcing a new dawn, taking us out of the disservices of the electric era, what McLuhan called the Marconi galaxy. So Pope is bemoaning what's coming in the Gutenberg galaxy, and Joyce is seeing a way of moving out of the Gutenberg galaxy into the Marconi galaxy. Well, then we come along, and if Joyce was optimistic, he was wrong. But, no, there's a lot of neat things that happen in society that never happened. Basically, for people in the West, their range of choice is incredible of what they can engage. So even more now than the 80s. So the
yes.
If there is a darkness to the chaos of the electric of the Marconi galaxy, we're now moving into the ionic. What would we call it? The ionic domain, ionic dimension. It's not a galaxy. It's not a constellation. So if we move into the ionic. We're here to describe the breakthrough. From what Joyce thought was a breakthrough. Now, who's snoring? They claim that you were snoring last week, Bert. Were you snoring?
No.
Okay.
I was snoring.
Yeah, somebody said, Carolyn, that they thought it was you. Somebody was snoring, but you, as far as you know, it wasn't you.
No, I know it wasn't me.
Well, see, it's just either, you know, it's either Yuri or, or Clyde. We got anybody else? No. unless it's Sarah. Anyways, I must have the smallest radio audience in the world. Apparently smallest. Lucky we got other worlds here eating it up.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're moving forward with the New Jerusalem, updated beyond the mythic stages of Pope and Joyce.
Yes. seemed like the person snoring as a response.
Yes, yes. Little man doesn't find this exciting at all. Little man just scared shitless. They no clue.
Bob, what I just read, the next paragraph discusses M.C. Escher's lithograph, Order and Chaos. Have you ever seen that?
I don't know. I've seen a lot of M.C. Escher designs. I don't know the titles of them, so I assume I've seen it.
Order and Chaos looks very interesting. It almost looks like the angel diagram.
Yeah. Well, you do have that in the middle of the angel diagram. You have the Escher going up and down at the same time.
Yes. And then there's a reference to Paul Klee's twittering machine. And
right.
McLuhan was pretty fascinated by that. And the description that I have of McLuhan, it says, Theo says, McLuhan quips that Klee's painting is a preview of the TV aerial, an electric configuration pattern to pick up non-visual energy.
Yes, it's pronounced Klee, Paul Klee.
Klee, okay.
The painting twittering machine is in Through the Vanishing Point, the 1968 book, and it's like these little thin lines and with little objects on the end of them. It does look like a bunch of thin TV aerials, a dance of TV aerials.
Yeah.
So that's the networking, the gridding, the interface of electronic connecting to create the effect of TV, radio, or other electric media. These delicate, subtle threads that connect the largely tactile spaces of electricity.
Yes. Also, I have a question for you. Can you describe, Theo describes, he references McLuhan's resonant interval.
Yeah.
And I'm picking up, I'm just asking, would that be McLuhan's resonant interval, would that be light, color, and sound? Or what is the resonant interval?
No,
interval
the resonant interval is another term for tactility, which is not a sense. It's the interplay of the senses. It's actually Linus Pauling's book, The Chemical Bond, I think it's called, 1939, where Pauling, you know, went on to win some Nobel Prizes. I think he won two. He describes that the bond in nature at the level of chemistry is not a connecting thing. It's an interface. It's a resonant bond. It's non-visual, non-connecting. And so then McLuhan takes that resonant bond and says, yes, that's happening in our electric media, the tactile interplay. So it can't be light, sound, movement, but it would be the interplay of them.
Wow.
You know?
Okay.
The interplay of any of the various senses would be the tactility.
Okay, so resonant interval is tactility. That's, wow. No, thanks for that. That's.
So what were they, light, sound, and movement, or light, sound, and something else?
Yes, lights. Well, there's light, sound, and light, color, and sound.
Oh, okay. Well, if you had movement, you would have the three, the visual, light, sound, acoustic, and movement, the kinetic. So that's three of your senses. And depending on what school you are, you have one more or two more. But to show at least three, Thiel is pointing to tactile interval. He's certainly aware of tactility as the interplay of sensory life, not the senses themselves. He knows that. And the twittering machine is a good painting of that resonant bond. And also Paul Klee. Theo makes a big deal out of Klee. He makes a big deal of Paul Klee, Marcel Duchamp, and Joyce. Those three from different art forms are like major probers of the 20th century and did similar art.
Yes. Well, but it's fun to read, Theo. It's fun. It's really fun. I was digging through some notes yesterday, and I found something at the end, and I got another confirmation about why Ion came to talk to you.
What was that?
I remember in Bobfest, you opened up your Evergreens treasure chest.
Right.
And you played the History of the Universe, and I found some notes that I typed out when I was working, listening to it the best I could, of how the Evergreens laid out the History of the Universe to you. And then when I was reading it, I'm like, there's no wonder Ion came through and talked to Bob, because this was so far. I mean, the ideas that they talked about how this universe was developed or created, the language so far out that it really opened you up, that it's unbelievable about the two different universes, the spirit and then the dense universe, and how time is different. I found how they gave an explanation to you about DNA.
Oh, did they? What did they say?
It said the spirit. Well, there's just one. Well, there's a whole paragraph, but then when I was typing at work, I didn't get the full fill-in, but I found this one sentence at the end. It said, spirit worked in the original girders, DNA, to replicate protein.
They're saying spirit works in there. That's the chromosome 14. That's non-physical. That's what Ion's talking about.
Yes. And then they also, there was a discussion about how once life began as a self-replicant, then the concept of life as an expression of free will within evolution became understandable. And then there was the last sentence that said, the spirit has access to all times, and that made me think of Ion, because Ion came through, and they first said spirit, but then they changed it to non-physical, because how the word spirit would be crossed up in this time.
So they say all times.
Yes.
That's the Evergreens. That's the actual phrase they said.
Actual phrase, yes.
So about that history. Oh, yeah. What was funny is that I was thinking about those recordings, that particular topic, a day or two ago. I never think about it too much, but I was thinking about it. I bet you I was picking up on your thoughts about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you were doing this 2 days ago?
Just yesterday. It just popped in for me to look around, and I found this, and then I looked into it, and it's just, and it was, what, September 28th, 1994, History of the Universe.
Right, which is, just a few months after the Paul Krasner interview. Same year, 94.
Yeah.
But the, yesterday, very recently, yesterday, the day before, I was thinking about I wonder what people think of who are listening to it, what they're thinking of the Evergreens material about the beginning of the universe. That's actually the content of my thoughts. Because I'll be winding up the Bop Fest, the music, 36 hours next week or so, and then I'm going to go listen to the whole Bop Fest, all 144 hours.
Wow.
While doing the dishes. It's going to take a while, but I'm going to hear all this stuff that I broadcast again. So I was thinking about that. That's part of the reason why I was thinking about the various knowledge scapes I put on there. I mean, I give a summary of all kinds of things from the beginning and then the early, dinosaur era and then the next era and then Cro-Magnon man. We work our way right through the history of the physical world.
Yes, but it just shows how open for you to open yourself up to allow that just to hear those words, that information, and just to let it come through, and now look at it where you have ION.
Right.
Here, which you and Carolyn are the, and JW are the only people that have a clue of what that really is, and you've brought it in this forum so that we can have some ideas and some interaction with it. But it's amazing. When I read this, it was like, wow. Because, yeah. I mean, if you read this to someone back in 1994, if you shared this in 1994 to people on the radio, they would have totally rejected it. Not rejected it, but they would have thought it was crazy.
Or a New Age cliche. They would have put cliche.
Very New Age cliche, yes.
Yeah, they wouldn't have heard it fine words. They would have just a general blanket. Oh, that sounds like New Age crap. You know what I mean? The word spirit would make them think a certain way. Yeah, you get a habitual response. But actually, what I'm presenting there is probably the best history pre-ION that a medium could come up with. I mean, they're very intelligent sounding.
Yes.
The Evergreens. And I had the luck of hanging out with them for many years. So I had good company, and then that prepared me for ION's completion.
Yes. But I found that interesting, very interesting.
And, you know, I used to think how lucky I was having the Evergreens and then noticing that no one else was interested.
Snore.
Yes.
One other item.
Took the time. Maybe they thought it was too expensive, you know, trivial stuff. They just didn't think that they should not find out what this phenomenon was. I mean, Michael was the best medium around, so I thought, well, that's worth noticing, engaging. Just as when Ion showed up, that became the best thing to engage. It's obvious.
Yes. But it also shows that opened up the hidden arsenal that you have on anyone else that was present at the time of doing any type of talking, that you opened your world up to engage the non-physical, or what you would want to call that paranormal or whatever, how you would use it back then, to open yourself up to that. And here you are with the ultimate.
Right.
The non-physical environment, the non-physical.
So what you're saying is the high quality of the Evergreens, if you allowed yourself to experience that, then it's almost a prerequisite. You got to get the gold of the Evergreens to be able to handle the diamonds of ION or something, you know? You got to allow yourself to be in that luxury. Because it was luxurious listening to the Evergreens talk.
It's very scientific sounding, the way they tone and how everything was presented.
They can do that. So, that's so basically we're showing the intelligence of what I interacted with, and then that prepared for an even more complete intelligence.
Yes, with the sense of humor.
And I may not have realized how much change one went through in dealing with these things. Just engaging a couple of times in 1980 with the Evergreens, that would have been enough for most people, or that was pretty cool. But to keep on doing it and do 64 sessions, you know, for the next 24 years,
wow!
Not many people would put their time and money into that.
Also, didn't you say that when ION came forth, you tried to, I think Greg is probably the only other Evergreen person that's still around. I mean, I think the other Evergreen people were just still listening to recordings. Is that correct?
Yeah, as opposed to what? They were listening to recordings, but.
Yeah, but listen, as opposed to coming in and forth and engaging with you in ION.
Oh, yeah. There's Howard Pearl, there's several. Even Michael's wife, she considered having a session but didn't do it. Yeah, none of them. Greg's the only one who came forth. George's son had a session, but he apparently wasn't too impressed with it. No, as far as I know, there's no Evergreens. Sue Bone had one session with the Evergreens. Neufeld had a session with the Evergreens and then had one with Ion. Bob Marshall had a session with the Evergreens and then was given one in 2009 with Ion, but he hadn't followed up on it. So, yeah, nobody, I mean, I tease George. You know, every Saturday night in the middle of the show, we get his weekly blog. You know, he writes just some kind of little column. And we get it in the middle of our payday. And for several times, I wrote him back. I responded, said, why don't you come here and talk to Ion? You know, right now, instead of typing up this stuff. Send that out on Sunday. Come by. Yeah, it's interesting how people, I think some people in the New Age world who hear this, they just find Ion too irreverent. Doesn't sound serious. Doesn't sound like there's any core values there.
Hmm. Well, that's something that I wonder. I think you were talking about it last week, about why the New Age gurus or just anyone's not here engaging Ion to open themselves up or just to disengage. It's just maybe that Ion may be a threat, not a threat, but it would bring them against themselves, I guess, what they would present.
Yeah, the deeper part of themselves that they think they've already in touch with. Now, did you know my post about Arakawa, the conceptual artist, and what they found in his home? The Dylan archive? Did you read that?
Yes. That was the post where you said that Ion opened that up.
Yeah, I'm saying that the Ion found these.
Yes.
Made the world recover the Dylan recordings. And there they were in a home that I'd spent time at. And that Ion did the memorial, shared the memorial tribute to Arakawa in May 2010. I think it was in May. You can listen to it. It goes on for almost three hours. Arakawa comes through Ion, or Ion says what Arakawa is thinking, you know, the recently deceased Arakawa. And Arakawa is criticizing these academics who are trying to take over his foundation and carry on his work. He's mocking them. So Ion had an intimacy with Arakawa. I haven't checked with Ion yet about it, but in light of Ion dropping things back, they may have dropped the Dylan stuff back just to have this unfolding of a secret web that me and Carol and JW are involved in.
Wow.
I mean, all the Dylan recordings are found in a guy who's connected to Ion slightly in his building. This Dylan treasure cache. Sounds a little suspicious to me. I mean, you got the Beatnik letter of the 50s, and we were involved with Gerd, who gets the rewards of that. Then you have the Dylan world of the 60s. So what would happen in the 70s? You know, David Bowie, something in his career or his bank account will strike headlines, and there will be me somehow connected to it. So one of the links I post on Dupes is an article by the guy who eventually buys the Dylan cassettes or acetates, whatever they are, and there's an article on. Yeah, in that article, which is written by him, the other article is just New York Daily News writing about it. In the one where this guy gives the step-by-step moves he made to acquire it and how he found out about it, there's a short bit. How do I say this? So, yes, in the article that's published somewhere by the collector who bought all the stuff, he's writing about it. He includes a New York Daily News or New York Post article. It's a small little thing, but you can expand it. And underneath the history of the building, and Dylan using the first floor, and Arakara and Madeline Ginn's being the owners, is a logo. And it says New DNA Info. I think I'll make sure I'm reading it right. Did you see that? The actual logo is referenced to Ionic, New DNA Info.
That's in the article that the collector posted.
Yes, the collector has a clipping. He includes a clipping from one of the New York papers. And you can enlarge it and read what the clipping's saying, but the clipping has like a commercial or ad at the end of it. I'm bringing it up here. And so that you got that amazing synchronicity of New DNA Info. That's how you could translate ION. Is there at the bottom point of the article. It's like obvious. It's this little sign that ION created.
Yeah, DNAinfo.com. Is that what that you're talking about?
Yes, you're looking
Dylan?
At it. Yeah.
Yes.
Dylan doesn't even look like Dylan. You know, the picture of Dylan's head?
He yes, Dylan
odd.
Building Village for Sale. And it's at the end, DNAinfo.com, New York. Wow.
It's not New DNA. It just says DNAinfo.com, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So what, look at that, DNAinfo.com. Why is that there? On this, right under the Ionic artists, Ginz and Arakawa, right under their names. It's pretty neat.
Yes. Well, that's a signature.
Yeah,
show that they did.
It's like a patent stamp by ION. We made this event. I mean, look, come on. You have a DNAinfo.com in the plot that ION did this, and that's what ION's known for. How come that's there in the article?
It's yes,
obvious. Who would put that there?
Wow, that's funny.
Okay, have you got anything else?
Yes, I read McLuhan books. I went and dove back into The Mechanical Bride.
Yeah?
And
when you read, you'll say, I never read this before. They changed the book. It's all new.
Yeah, it is. But I read Coeducation.
Yeah.
It made me think of What Youth, and then also the next page, The Poor Rich.
Right.
And then I have your notes that you did highlighting on.
Yes.
Those
I posted.
Those you posted, and I found the Poor Rich chapter quite interesting. And then what tying us back is that I started the other chapter of Thiel talking about McLuhan and satire, and the
right.
Bride is discussed, and the Mechanical Bride is a very interesting book to read.
It's well written, it's rich, it's old fashioned prose, it's like not as flippant as Counterblast and some of the later McLuhan books. He's laying out a training of perception there for you.
Yes.
Here, keep talking. I got to use the bathroom, so just you.
Okay.
Put you on mute.
Sure. And there was one. Where is it? Where's the quote? I'm finding the quote regarding the poor rich. Oh, okay. It's about life is dull for these children who cannot share the collective passion for those who hope to be rich. The speed, the struggle, the one-man fury are not for them. And McLuhan is discussing, I guess, the rich today where they are setting up like a monopoly for their empires where they become more like workaholics or robots. But that's there's another quote. Where is the quote? Lifestyle. Yes, that's the one. Life is dull for these children of the rich who cannot share the collective passion of those who hope to be rich. The speed, the struggle, the one-man fear are not for them. And that struck me. It made me think of another McCoolin quote that you were discussing with Roxy a few weeks ago about the unconscious, about how wealth is developed by stupidity. And I was wondering if you could explain that. About the, what was it? I have it. The note. Yes, how wealth is born. Creates wealth. It's discussion of the TV unconscious. How people engaged in the TV conscious willingly, so they made themselves done consciously. And you consider consider the unconscious as acting dumb. And this is how wealth is born. So that's the discussion of the chemical unconscious, the TV unconscious, the digital unconscious, and then the McLuhan unconscious.
Yeah, the stupidity part is, McLuhan was saying, we heard him several times saying, people jump in their cars and drive downtown to their jobs and offices to do their business on the phone, where they could just as much do their business at home in the suburbs on the phone. So there are different reasons why they go downtown, but that's an example of, you know, unnecessary using, having a car and all the products that go in a car, and then all the going to restaurants for dinner or noon hour lunch and all that stuff. All the consumption that goes on stupidly, where it didn't have to happen if you used to recognize what the telephone brought in, that you didn't really have to go down to your office. So stupidness is people using the older media, like diehards. Just keep the older media going. Can't take the best from the new media and create a new society, a new structure. So all this obsolete money wealth is created by stupidity, by rearview mirror activities. And in a world where most information, most experience was free, what was the point of making money? To go buy clothing, buy new shoes? Most people would engage on television. That's where the wealth was. That's where the new imagery, the new information, the new scenarios, you'd wallow around in. And that's relatively inexpensive for the 50s, 60s, 70s, so which is McLuhan's era. So you see, the actual consumption world is, and millions are made from it, billions, is a stupid activity. It's inefficient. You're not using the environment around you to probe it, to have wealth. You get wealth from the software imagery of a TV screen. And it's wealth where you don't have any garbage to pick up after. You don't have to, pick up your burger or whatever it is and put in the garbage can. You can watch TV, hear the radio, and there's no evidence you did. So that's the beginning of looking at rearview mirror activities. Create old-fashioned wealth. And, you know, it got to the point where if you get a lot of wealth, you had to give it back. It had to be recycled. So wealth ain't what it used to be.
Flash forward into where we are now with the internet and all the shrinking or the merging of all the bodies, then we're in really a, that reminds me, that's you, it reminds me that the environment that we're in. No, I'm sorry. What you said when you